Hello and welcome to the CG Garage, episode number 9, brought to you by Chaos Group. This podcast features Graham Fife and Jay Bush. They both work for the Institute of Creative Technology, which most people know as ICT. They both work under Paul Debevec, and he's been doing a lot of stuff. If you don't know who Paul is, you should probably look him up. And we talk about some of the research they've done, specifically on scanning and different things they're doing there. They also talk about their backgrounds a little bit. I've actually known Graham for many years and worked with him, and you'll quickly figure that out as we're pretty close friends and got a really good sense of humor. I've known Jay for a long time as well, just from going back and forth with ICT. And she's really interesting because she actually has a background of being an artist who got hired by a research institution to help them out. So seeing that transition of going from artist to research is pretty cool. We talk about a lot of stuff. We talk about WikiHumans. We talk about scanning. We talk about lots of details. It gets fairly technical, but also it gets pretty amusing at the same time. So hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, because I had a real blast doing this podcast, and we hope to do more of these just like this one.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Does that work? You guys feel comfortable?
Yep.
You guys good?
I can hold this position for about 10 minutes or so.
10 minutes or so? So that's actually what people do, right, on the light stage? They have to hold a position
for
about
10? 3 seconds.
Yeah, it's 3 seconds?
Minutes. Yeah, or yeah. Less.
It's 3 seconds. That's pretty good. Six seconds?
It's three seconds, 16 images.
You do 16 images in 3 seconds?
Mm-hmm.
That's how many patterns you do?
Right.
And then you can get every light based on those patterns.
Well, lighting direction and understanding how light falls onto a surface.
Right.
Yeah, we do a few different things with the lights.
With the lights, okay.
And we can go faster if we can make the lights brighter, but you have to kind of cross that line of when you're starting to blind the subject.
Right, so there's a comfortableness that happens as well. How fast are your shutter speeds?
Usually 1 over 20, which doesn't seem that fast, but you're holding a pose, so
okay,
it works out. You know what's funny?
What?
People with different eye colors tend to have different sensitivity.
Really?
Yeah, it's weird.
So people with blue eyes had a tendency to blink more.
Oh, they're more sensitive to the light.
Some people with really pale blue eyes,
right,
can't handle as much light.
Interesting.
They don't teach you that in school.
Well, maybe they teach that in, you know, ophthalmology school, or not in everyday school, not in computer science classes, right?
Right.
We didn't cover it in art school, so.
Yeah. Okay. So you went to art school.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And when was that?
2003 to 2007. I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Not too bad.
And right out of art school, you went to work for ICT?
Yeah, they found me at my portfolio show, and I got into a wager with the producer at the time. If I could understand his technology, so he showed it to me, and if I won, he had to eat the chocolate, and if I didn't win, he didn't have to eat the chocolate.
But everybody loves chocolate.
Well, he didn't want the chocolate.
I don't understand the chocolate part.
I'm not sure if I believe portfolio, this story.
No, I swear to God. A portfolio show, they have you put pictures and chocolates and to lure people to come and see your portfolio. And at the time it was Tom. And
where was this?
Oh, we used to rent a hotel down in Santa Monica.
No, but what art school?
Oh, Art Institute of Santa Monica.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And he kept walking by my booth and teasing me about like trying to lure people with chocolate. And I told him he should get a chocolate. And he said only if I understood what normals were. And I don't know, it kind of progressed from there. And then after that, I was almost thinking about not calling to get an interview because I was intimidated. But then he called me and hunted me down and told me I had an interview. And then he hung up on me. And then I had to go to the interview.
Okay.
So, yeah. It was interesting.
And you'd been at ICT ever since?
Mm-hmm.
For how long? I saw it 7 years on your LinkedIn.
7 years now.
Wow. That's pretty good.
It doesn't feel that long. The best part was, though, my interview time. When I was being interviewed, the boys didn't know I was being interviewed for an artist position. So the first thing they asked me is, can I write? And I didn't know what to say to that. Because
you write code is what they meant.
I don't know what they meant. They had been on a SIGGRAPH deadline. They haven't slept in 4 days. And right. The only thing they kept doing was staring at me and then asked me if I could write.
That's interesting. And then what did you say? Yes?
Yeah. Blank sure. Look.
Sure. Yeah, that is kind of funny. So, but I didn't know what position you were being interviewed for.
Nobody did. Nobody even knew right. I was there.
Gotcha. Hold on a second. Sorry about that, guys. All right. Well, that's funny. And then, Graham, you met Paul through me.
I think that's correct. I knew about Paul from before.
Well, yeah, a lot of people knew about Paul.
Yeah, because he's done the cool stuff.
Right. The stuff.
So that's right.
Right. And then you well. We should let the listeners know this, but they'll find out also when we do our Ceiling Cat podcast, which will go into the Wayback Machine. But Graham and I worked together pretty closely. We worked in the same studio. We worked at Sway Studio for a while. And you were the chief of software or head engineer. What was your title?
I whatever. Went through a couple things. Yeah. Technical director.
Technical director.
And technical officer or something like that.
Right. Yeah. But you actually – or a CTO. You might have been a CTO at one point.
I think I was a CTO for a little while.
Yeah. Then Graham wrote a bunch of stuff. He wrote the biggest thing he wrote was the car simulator that we used a lot and marketed at Sway when we were there.
That was the demo he brought actually when you came for the job.
Yeah, I showed everybody that.
Yeah. I remember that's a fun that. One. But you also – what I also liked about Graham is that he would – he would also come up with the garage experiments, like the cheapest solution scanner you could possibly come up with. It'd be like a piece of paper with a torn out hole in it and a flashlight, and you would create like 20K this normal maps of a quarter.
That was also in your demo.
Well, yeah. There was some scotch tape involved. There was
there was scotch tape involved. Okay. So it was, and I think the total cost materials was about $5.
Yeah. That's when we were scanning coins.
Yeah, and we did scan a coin. I remember
that. We scanned a bunch of coins.
Yeah. We scanned a bunch of coins. And they were really – it was shockingly high quality considering how cheap you did it.
What camera did you use? I never got to find out.
Daniel's 5D.
Huh. Yeah.
We always used his Daniel's 5D. It was the go-to camera.
Daniel's?
No, it was the 1D.
That may have been the 1D, actually.
It was the 1D. It's 1DS.
I remember that was a fun project because we were trying to take these close-up macro – photos of these coins, and we had to take 20 or 30 shots of one coin, and they all had to line up, which sounds fine because you've got tripods and everything. But then when we were processing the data, I noticed we've got this kind of a epoxy floor that was put in.
Right.
And just leaning over, just leaning my body to one side to move a light to a different position.
Yep.
Was actually bending the floor, and it moved the coin like 4 or 5 pixels.
Oh, right.
And we're like, what is happening? Why are these images? Somebody shaking the camera.
But it was actually the floor that was deforming.
Yeah, you could lean one way or the other and just watch the camera go side to side. That floor, man.
That floor was a nightmare.
How thick was the epoxy?
It was this weird floor. It was this weird floor, and it was white. It basically looked like a hospital. And it was white, shiny, and there was no reason for it. We actually were talking about painting lines on, surgery over here, waiting over there, and post-op, and emergency, like all of that stuff. It would really look like a hospital floor. I remember that.
Yeah.
But anyway, that floor was a nightmare. The other thing that was funny about that floor is that they kept redoing the floor for some reason. Either the color wasn't right or it was cracking or something was wrong.
I think the first people who put it in didn't quite know what they were up against.
Right.
I think that's what it was.
That's probably why it was yielding so much. You had like 4 floors under it.
Yeah, it was weird. It was very strange.
Well, we put little markers around the coin, and it was fine.
Yes. Yes. So you guys all went to, well, you worked at ICT for 7 years. And so was she already there when you started, or?
Yeah, she was already there. A lot of people were already there.
Okay.
I've only been there 5.5
years. 5.5 years. Okay. And what is your title there?
Computer scientist.
Computer scientist. That's
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, that's my actual title, which is great. I think it's a great validation.
Yeah.
In school, I took computer science in school.
So now that makes you a computer scientist.
Yeah, but we would always say to each other in school that if you have to put the word science in the name of your field, that means it's not a real science.
Right.
So you have social science.
Yes.
Political science.
Yes.
And computer science.
Yes.
Ouch.
You know, real sciences are like biology.
Gee. You don't say chemistry. Physics scientist.
Yeah, exactly. There's no physics scientist.
There is no.
And we were always joking, there's no such thing as a computer scientist in the real world. Well, here I am.
All these years later, labeled as a computer scientist. That's pretty awesome, Graham. I like that.
But mostly I do research in graphics.
Computer graphics. Science.
Computer vision related stuff.
Vision
having
related.
To do with, mostly having to do with producing stuff for graphics.
Okay. And you basically, just so we clarify this, I'll probably put it in the intro, but you guys both work at ICT and you guys have been working together for a long time right now. So how long have you been in a new building?
Oh, that new building went up, oh boy.
So
I don't even
three,
know.
4 years ago?
We've been in that building for 4 years now.
4 years. Okay. Right.
I remember because I spent a year and some change at the old one. I think almost 2 years almost.
Right. Okay. I remember going to that old building several times. The first time I met Paul and sort of talking about ICT stuff, he was still working on the Parthenon project. Was just about to release that Parthenon project. And what was interesting, because this is related back to you and your involvement in the field, and I think it's probably why that started to happen, is he was interested in talking to us. I met him at a martini party at DD way back in the day, and we were chatting. He says, oh, I'd love to have you come over and check things out. And I thought, oh, that's awesome. I'd like to go see Paul. But actually, he had a motivation to it, is that he was doing his Parthenon project, and he was looking for artistic guidance on what he could do to make this look very appealing. Mm. And so he was looking for an artist's input, and that's why he obviously, I think it was effective and it looked really cool, and I think the Parthenon project was a really great project. But I think that sort of motivated him that he needed that input from an artist's point of view, which I think was really cool.
I just love the job because it's so strange. Nothing is the same.
No, you guys do all kinds of stuff, right?
Yeah, out of school, I was terrified that I'd be stuck in like the same thing every single day, rotoscoping or the same kind of thing every single day.
Well, and you're by definition doing something that no one's ever done before every day.
I actually had a teacher get mad at me for taking the job because he thought it was a failure. He thought that by not going into the industry, that I was hiding from the industry instead of the fact going into research is exploring. No, he told other classes this.
Told other classes about you and how much of a failure you were.
Mm-hmm. Wow. One of my other teachers found out, got pissed, and came and told me.
Why?
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with roto.
Yeah, but art is art. I mean, that's upsetting.
I actually wasn't that upset because a teacher who came and told me, who is actually one of my mentors, is Bo Jansen.
Okay.
And he's actually part of the reason I took the job I did was because he did a lot of the research and work behind Mystique Skin and things like that.
Right.
But then also he used to have fun doing like B horror films like Carrie 2.
Sure.
And all the fun they would have, like dressing mannequins up and shoving them full of jelly and then shooting them with high powered air rockets in high speed cameras so they can get like horror shots and. I don't know, he used to tell me, he's like, as long as you enjoy it, explore everything.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
That's true. I mean, working in production and working on shots and seeing final stuff going on the big screen, et cetera, that's very rewarding to and you know, I've done it. I did it for a while. I enjoyed it. I don't feel a need for it anymore. Mm-hmm. I enjoy doing what I'm doing. I'm a creative director at a software company, so And I feel very, very creative in the job that I do. So I'm very excited about this.
Well, I was always known as a generalist in school, so I had my finger in everything. So that's why when I started this job, they're like, well, you're going to have to learn a little of everything. I'm like, okay, I can do this.
That's what you can do, right.
Bring it.
But you have been focusing lately. Both of you guys have been focusing on a lot of stuff involving scanning of heads, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, face scanning is pretty popular.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually getting more popular within the last several years because mostly because of the improved computers and so on, it's become realistic to use this type of data in more applications.
Right.
Obviously movies, but even more than that. It used to be only the very high-end movies, but now basically any movie can deal with this sort of data. And
right.
One of the things that we're trying to do with you guys
is
make sure that people use the data properly.
That's right. So you want to get into that? Let's get into that. So
you open the door. So
I just parked my Segway over
that's
here.
That's right. So that's okay. One of the things I know this for a fact, and I got your data when I started working at DD, and we're working on certain data sets, right? And I remember one of the data sets we got was just someone was started to work on it, and it was kind of all over the place. And I was like, why doesn't it look right? Why doesn't it do this? And I started looking at it, and people were basically taking the data they were getting and loosely making other maps out of it, arbitrarily speaking. Figuring out, oh, well, I'll take what's this and just make that into a subsurface, and they just make it redder for no random reason, not really knowing what it's supposed to be or what it is, and then painting their own spec maps and everything else. So didn't really see the point of them, if they had scanned data, why did they use it, right? And so I remember specifically working on another movie we're working on where I basically had to do the raw data straight up, right? And it was for it was on Oblivion, and we had scanned the head for Tom Cruise so he could fight himself in battle. And there wasn't going to be that many shots, so the pressure wasn't that hard to, like, make super amazing ones. You just had to look really very convincing like him. And I literally just took the data you had, and I plugged it in just the way Graham taught me, which was stupidly simple. And it's gotten better. Like, there's more data you guys give me now. But it was literally just like diffuse, this, that, and then spec. And then you gave me a few tricks to remove reflection occlusion and ambient occlusion in the data set in a Nuke script. Just told me a little bit how to do it. And I took care of that. And it was darn good. It wasn't perfect by any – I didn't say it was like I'm going to do, you know, a full feature super close-up of the actor. But it was amazingly accurate with very little work. And I started realizing, I think we're overthinking this. I think we're overthinking ICT data. I think there's something that needs to be done where the conversation about what we're getting and what we put back has to go back and forth between you guys. Because I think part of the thing that I think is interesting is people take your data – but they never tell you what they do with it.
Sometimes we get renders back, but they don't tell what they did to get to that point.
Right. So you don't know how your texture maps are being put into a shader.
Well, I think these days there's more communication.
Okay.
So
on some projects.
Yeah, on some of the projects, there's definitely more communication.
Right.
I think a few years back, when you do facial scans, you might be used to some other scanning techniques,
right?
That aren't really delivering calibrated color and calibrated reflectance. And I think people are just used to that. Oh, it's a photo. Okay. It's got a color. Right. All right. It's color. So then they do artistic stuff to deal with that and make
their own
digital character. Yeah. But now people are starting to warm up to the idea that we've actually measured something and we're not just delivering snapshot of color. We're actually calibrating how bright this is relative to some, you know, color chart, calibration targets, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So something I think, well, some people still don't realize it, but you can explain it to them that, you know, if we have an image map, And the number in the map is 0.9.
Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't be 0.9. Let's say it's 0.6.
Yep.
That means that it reflects 60% of the light.
Right.
And that translates into the shader in whatever rendering system you're using.
That's the first thing. Is like, that's my reflection map, 60%.
Yeah. It's not like, oh, it's kind of gray.
Right.
No. It's 60%.
Right.
So I think more people are getting that idea that we're delivering real measurements. And then the question is, okay, great, we measured all these things, but they're not exactly the same things that the shader expects, or they're not exactly the maps that the shader runs off of.
Okay.
So we do need to figure out how to get what we measured to work with the shaders.
Right. Well, part of my motivation when I started looking at, starting the whole WikiHuman project was specifically to have a better dialogue with you guys and understand this more, and to publicly put that information out there, right? So as an example, since I started doing this a long time ago, you guys are actually delivering more maps and more detailed maps than you had in the past. I mean, you guys are continuously improving this stuff. So as an example, let's say you get a data set today, I know you guys are doing stuff that you can't talk about yet, but let's talk about what you can talk about. What is it that you guys will deliver today? If you give me a scan of a head, what am I going to get as a map?
Well, we do the diffuse color map.
Diffuse color, yeah. That is basically just no specular or anything else.
Yeah, no spec on it. And it's flatly lit,
yep.
So it's nice and flat.
There's not any... You try to take out as much ambient occlusion out of that map as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's one of the more recent things we're doing is we're also estimating ambient occlusion, and so we can take it out. So we deliver with and without.
So since you already know the model, you basically calculate what would the ambient occlusion be on that model and then subtract that out of the diffuse map.
Well, that's actually the old way.
Oh, what's the new way?
The new way is it's kind of an optical trick you can do with the data that we're capturing.
Okay.
You can estimate how much occlusion there is based on these gradient photographs that we take.
Oh, really?
So even without the model, we can estimate the ambient occlusion.
Which one's more precise?
I don't know. I suspect, I never got a satisfactory result from the method using the model.
Right.
Maybe because the shader's too simple or something. But the way to do it with the photographs seems to work pretty well.
Okay.
I would think with the geometry, you're also limited by your poly count and stuff like that. Versus with the optical, the only thing that you have is pixels and information.
Yeah, it's something about actually taking a photograph of what's really happening, not relying on an algorithm to estimate it. Anyway, so that's the diffuse, and that's basically... it's the light that goes into the skin and bounces around a little bit and picks up some color and then comes out. And that's what we call diffuse.
That's what you call diffuse.
Yeah. So it's stuff that went in a little bit. Then there's specular, which everybody
knows
yep. about, which is on skin, has no color. And so using that polarization technique that we've always been using since...
Unless you've been rubbing yourself with oil. That's no color.
Well.
Okay, but go ahead.
We won't get into that,
yeah.
Chris.
So
keep that on your own time.
Okay. But go ahead. Tell me about the how you get the specular map.
Right. So using the linear polarizing filters on the lights and on your camera, if you're... into photography, you might know you can put polarizing filters on your camera to cancel out reflections off of water or windows and that sort of thing. So you can do the same thing on skin if you also put polarizing filters on your lights. And then you can turn the filter one way or the other, and then you've either got the shine or you don't have the shine.
And then you subtract one from the other, and you get the difference, and that's...
Yeah, so you can see what is only the shine in the... difference between those two. So that's something that we've delivered for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So to improve on that, we also throw in an estimate of the Fresnel curve.
Oh, okay. How do you?
You know about Fresnel, right?
Yes, I've heard about it.
I've heard you may know about Fresnel. Yeah.
So tell me about Fresnel.
Yeah. Well, anyway,
explain it to those who may not actually know.
So one of the other pieces of data we get is the surface normal, which is basically the angle that the surface makes at every point. And the idea behind Fresnel is that the amount of light that bounces off a surface depends on the angles. So it depends on the angle to the light and also the angle to the viewer. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at something edge on, it'll be shinier than if you look at it straight on.
Yep.
That's the basic idea. And then there's some math in there. You don't want to hear about that.
Okay.
But you can kind of estimate this based on the normal and then factor it out so you get more of a flat lit looking specular map.
So you get a specular map which does not account for Fresnel.
Yeah.
And then you know the Fresnel value?
Yeah, so there's a weird thing there.
Okay.
I'll get into that. But basically, shaders all have the good shaders have the Fresnel built into them. So you want to feed in a map that doesn't have the Fresnel yet. So the shader adds the Fresnel and everything looks great.
Yeah.
So that's the idea there. And the weird thing with skin and Fresnel is that skin isn't like a smooth surface.
No.
So if you plug in the regular values for Fresnel equations, it doesn't really look right on skin.
Hmm.
So we base it on measured values and then kind of find a curve that sort of fits it nice. We just use that. So I think there is some interesting work yet to be done. I don't think anybody's really doing Fresnel properly on skin. That's something we should all be looking into a bit more.
Okay, that's good. We should look into that. That sounds like a good idea. The other thing I want to know, okay, so now you've got that. The other thing that you guys are doing more recently is you guys always have provided, obviously the model you get is a certain level of model and you provide a displacement map.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's one more thing.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead, Graham.
One more thing.
Yeah, you sound like Steve Jobs. Go ahead.
It's good.
The iPhone. Sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Right. So the light that doesn't get into the diffuse color and that ends up in the specular color, it's actually not all specular, which is something recent we've been working out with these scans.
What is it?
Some of it is single scattering.
Oh, yes. Tell me about that.
This is light that just barely got into the skin and then bounced out.
So if you were to – okay – and you and I have talked about this a little bit, and I'm starting to think about this a lot more. But if you were to say, let's say you were going to explain this to someone who doesn't understand anything about shaders, right? So
I would say first thing to do is read up and learn everything you can about shaders. And then we can talk.
No, but
now, there is something to say.
Let me just put it this way. If I were to say it's the first level of like probably like dead skin or something that's on the surface.
You can talk about layers.
Layers of skin. It's the very first layer of skin that's on your face.
Yeah, the skin kind of has, well, let's see, starting from outside going in, light can bounce off various things on your skin. The first thing it could bounce off is the oil on the surface.
As a reflection.
Yeah. And that would be the specular layer. Mm-hmm. Okay. So all that light goes into the specular. And then if it gets past the oil and goes into the skin just a little and bounces out without doing too much else, that's the single scattering. Okay. And then beneath that, there's this kind of diffuse and then there's subsurface and all that. But if you were to look at just the single scattering layer, it would look like you just have a gray face. It's like, it's really weird. You know, Blue Man? Gray Man.
It would be like Gray Man.
Just all the same gray everywhere, just a dark gray.
Right.
It's kind of weird, but that's what it looks like.
Yeah. And I'm actually, when you first explained it to me, and this is I'm actually want to go What I'm going to do on our WikiHuman page is I actually want to go through this with you and just go, here's what you have and here's how you put it together because of that specific logic, and explain what each one of these maps is that we know of. I'm not saying it's going to be the be-all data that we know of, but I think that so far with that data set, it would be good to understand that. And it's very – what I find interesting is that you basically, when we first looked at this, you said just – make it diffuse. There's no subsurface in a single scatter. Don't consider it as a subsurface map, I guess, or maybe it's too shallow a subsurface to be considered.
Exactly. So you want to use your surface normal map and whatever, or if you're using the displacement.
Right.
You don't want to have any scattering in the single scattering.
Right.
Because it's only, you know, it's single scattering. It's not multi.
Right. Multi. So yeah. Okay.
It doesn't get a chance to go very far before it bounces.
That's really interesting, actually. To me, it's really interesting, and I'm definitely seeing the benefits of using it, and something I want to get into. And then the displacement map is what gives you a lot more detail that you would want, or you could use a normal map. But I think people, the normal map is going to give you simply, is basically going to change the angle of reflection that you're dealing. But with a displacement map, you're actually going to be able to give that attribute to the model.
Alter the surface so that way it actually responds.
Right. And you guys are doing some very, very high quality displacement map. Can you tell me about the displacement maps or the quality of the displacement maps?
Yeah. So we do the standard resolution.
What's the standard resolution?
Based on the photography we do with the.
It's like 6K or something like that,
right? Yeah. It comes in at about 4 to 6K before you're kind of wasting pixels.
Okay.
Just because of how many pixels you have in the original photos anyway.
Gotcha.
So that's what we call the standard resolution. But beyond that, there is a paper from a couple of years ago where we've been doing this thing called microgeometry or micro displacements. And the idea is if you had lots of time, you could get in real close with a macro lens and do a whole bunch of scans of like different patches of your face.
Yep.
Like get right in there.
Because we're not invasive enough as it is.
Yeah. And basically you can fill the whole frame with like a 1.5 centimeter patch of skin.
Right.
But nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to have their entire face scanned like 1 centimeter at a time.
Yeah, it would take days and it'd be really annoying.
Yeah, but it looks great. So that was some work we did. There's a PhD student actually at our lab a couple of years ago named Paul Graham. He worked on this project.
And edited the project.
Yeah, he was the project.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the idea was to scan some example patches from your face, like different parts of your face, and then use texture synthesis algorithms to propagate those examples over the entire face scan.
So you use the 4K or 6K map as a basis to generate a higher resolution map.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of based on this idea of image analogies, which is an idea from a while back. Or if you have two example images, image A and image B, and they're somehow related, then you have an image C, you're like, okay, A is to B as C is to what?
Gotcha.
And so there's an algorithm for that based on texture synthesis. And sometimes it's called constrained texture synthesis because you're synthesizing a texture, but you're trying to respect some relationship to the data that you have.
Yep.
So in this case, we've got low res. We call it low res, but, you know, 6K.
Yeah.
Low res displacement, and then we have this high res patch.
And how many patches do you guys need to do?
We usually do five.
Okay. So Jay knows specifically, right? You go in there, you say you want a forehead, you want a nose, or?
You basically want to test every region where the skin starts to differ. So the skin stretches on the forehead differently than it would on the tip of the nose, for example, or the cheek has a lot more deeper pores, and while the tension on the forehead stretches them a bit thinner. So we tend to get a sample from the forehead, the nose, the cheek, the temple, and we call it the jaw, but I mean, sometimes it's stubble or something of that nature.
Okay. So cool. And then you basically say, okay, based on these five areas, I can fill in the rest of the face.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And with those algorithms, you still have things lining up with the pores and the wrinkles and so on. So it doesn't look like just you threw on some noise.
Yeah.
Although
yeah.
throwing on noise also works pretty great if you don't happen to have this data.
So just using noise works just as well?
I wouldn't say just as well, but it works pretty well. And that was used on the Digital IRA project that we did with Activision R&D.
Interesting.
Since that's in a real-time context,
okay.
They came up with some noise functions that kind of resemble the high-detailed scans.
It was the sine wave noise, so it had the waves in it.
I remember this now, yeah.
So it breaks up the specular shine, so it looks like microgeometry. Once you start to get certain closeness, you start to notice the repetition.
And now I remember because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember Paul talking about this. They were having trouble because they were doing real time, they were having trouble loading this gigantic map in there to memory. So they made a fractal version or their own procedural version of it so they didn't have to load the map, and it worked almost as well as the actual
data. One of the best things that you get from this micro displacement or microgeometry is breaking up highlights. And that's something skin does and a lot of digital characters don't do. So you throw that in and it kind of adds a little bit of life to the skin.
I'll put links to these papers so that people can see the difference between before and after.
The video has a nice side by side where you can see the difference.
Yes, I remember that. But people, if they may not have seen it, I'll make sure that they have an opportunity to see it. Mm-hmm. Well, that's really cool. And you guys have, on top of doing all this research and improving what you guys have known and sort of doing what you're doing, you guys actually scan a lot of faces. So your data set has been used in a lot of features.
Yeah.
Video games, movies, and other media.
Okay. So that's kind of an interesting thing because you guys are almost like a production area in the same time.
Well,
not really.
Sort of.
I understand. I mean, you guys have patents on everything and you're doing what you're doing and but if someone wants to go and get a high quality scan, they have several options, including ICT, but that's generally a pretty good place to go to get a scan done in some cases.
Well, we try. So basically, like we regulate the pipeline to a point, then we hand it off to one of our licensees, and then that allows us to continue to push the envelope and try more experimental ways.
Right.
And then people want to come with the knowledge that the data they're getting is as high and as good as it can be, but as well as understanding it is somewhat experimental at the same time.
Right.
So, I mean, if they want to try the newest stuff out there, then they would come to us. If they just need 36 different people scanned at a regular kind of...
Then they can go to one of the guys' licensees.
Yeah.
Which I think is really interesting. I mean, I've always been a fan of what you guys are doing. There's always something interesting that you guys are doing. There's always trying to improve the light stage, change light stage. I think you have seen you guys swapping out different lights, trying out different colors, trying out different...
And we've broken it a bunch of times.
Yeah.
More than a bunch.
Yeah. I remember going into the giant light stage you guys built. Is that still up and running?
Oh, he's still alive, yeah.
Yeah?
It works great. I wasn't part of that project, but
that one was huge.
That was 2006, wasn't it?
Yeah, 2006. That was a little bit before I arrived. But it's just a mile down the street from the other one.
Yep.
It's a lot of fun. It's been featured in...
The Congress.
Yeah, the Congress, a major motion picture.
Really?
And
I
also,
mean, the actual thing itself?
Mm-hmm.
The actual thing.
It's a set.
And I believe it's also made an uncredited appearance in Deus Ex Machina,
really?
The video game.
Seriously?
I don't think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Is it Machina?
Machina.
That sounds more familiar.
You of all people should know this, Chris.
Why me?
This sounds like something you should know.
Okay.
Okay. You should.
Work on that. Even if I did know, I probably won't pronounce it correctly. I'm very good at not pronouncing things correctly.
All right. I'll buy that.
Yeah. But if I didn't, I don't. Yeah, I'm not. Certain video games I play, certain video games I don't. Yeah, I'm not interested. I'm not into them.
Don't look at me. I play a lot of games, so I don't know that one.
I think it's kind of a dystopian science fiction sort of situation where they had some evil device, which is essentially the light stage.
Oh, nice. So they modeled it in the game?
It looked a lot like it.
It's a real dumbed-down model of it, though.
Well, they had the clusters of six lights.
It does look – when you go into that big light stage, and again, I'll try to put a link on it. Yeah. If you go into to the big lights, it does look like it's a time travel machine, like some kind of a
– No, that's only happened a couple of times.
Well, that you know of because it keeps happening over and over again. You just
same
don't
guy. Really,
same guy. Yeah. But it does look like a time travel machine, which is pretty awesome.
I like
every time you go in there
– Yeah.
By the time you come out, it does feel like you've traveled forward in time by at least 10 or 15 minutes. So,
touche.
That's true. That's true. All right. Well, that's cool. Let me see. I had a couple other things. Right. So,
are you going to edit this?
No, I'm not.
Oh, oh dear.
Why? Do you worry about it? Have you heard, well, you said you've heard a couple of these podcasts.
Yeah, but
are they edited?
No.
They sound fine. Here's the thing I've learned from doing these podcasts so far is that when I do them, I'm like, I don't know if this is going well. And after I listen to it, it actually is pretty entertaining and pretty good. So I wouldn't worry.
Just the way you went over and checked your notes there.
No. Well, I was checking to see if there was something specifically that I didn't meet. But I want to fast forward a little bit. To, you know, we establish at this point how you guys are doing scans, certain scans you're doing. Jay, you get very involved with the data set, right?
Yeah. The capturing side as well as the processing side.
That's right. You capture as well. So you're always there. Whenever I've done a scan over at ICT, I've seen you being involved and helping out and just understanding that process.
Yeah. Shiming and I are usually the ones in charge of running the light stage.
Okay.
Yeah. Shiming is our electrical engineer.
Slash crazy scientist.
Slash genius.
He was the one I met that was putting in all the crazy lights recently.
He's in charge of electrical. Usually I'm in charge of hardware.
Okay.
So metal. And then the two of us together run the shoot and manage cameras and data. And then after that, it goes to my table again.
Okay.
Where I do processing with the software that Graham tends to create. And then why are you laughing?
Tens?
Well, okay, you have to remember.
No, that's just a funny way to describe it.
I tend
to write the software.
Well, okay, so
it's like
I
a
used
bad
to
habit that I have.
But you have to remember who used to write the software and the kind of things I had to put up with, okay? So I'm happy you make
it's
the software.
All good. It's all good.
Anyway, so the software's actually come a long way and it's a lot better now, thanks to Graham. Yeah. There are some horror stories. But it processes and then I run it through, do a quality check in the renders. And then if it goes further into more of an artistic field, like, you know, texturing the back of the head, fixing up to full body
right.
kind of stuff.
Or you need something for a publication or you mm-hmm. do something like that, you've been
I tend to handle it. Or if we do body scans, then I'm the one in charge of managing and texturing and dealing with the data.
Gotcha.
So.
Well, that's cool. And so what I think is interesting, so I told you about my reaction towards the data we're getting from ICT is that some people don't necessarily just take what they have and understand what they have and that they want to do something different with it. So I wanted to do something where I work more closely with you guys, and that's when I decided to form this little group, the Digital Human League. And you guys were some of the first people to get involved, which was awesome. You guys right away, it's like, Paul and got you Graham and Jay involved, and it was perfect. And we really started discussing things. I like the fact that I can sit there and I have these questions and I want to work with this data set. And I feel that there's a much better communication between the scientific acquisition of things and the artistic need and how one needs to feed off the other so that there's no interpretation.
That's actually really funny because by working in the lab, I've kind of somewhat alienated myself from a lot of my friends because they don't understand the scientific side anymore. So
right.
Whenever I go to lunch with them, we'll talk about textures and stuff. Like Brad was saying, you know, 0.6 means, you know, it's 60% of the brightness. It doesn't mean that to most of my friends.
What does it mean to them?
Well, to them, they get a diffuse map and that's just a color. It doesn't mean the scattering information or anything like that.
Right.
They don't understand that diffuse can have specular information in it if you don't separate it appropriately. Most people, they just take photographs,
right,
and they put it in, they like paint out the highlight, and they don't completely understand.
Right.
And it's not their fault. I mean, I know I work with students a lot coming in and out of school, and they don't cover it on a scientific level, because a lot of the students that go to art schools, they don't want to hear about it on the artistic or scientific level, so they don't completely understand it. So they actually, my teacher I was telling you about, he went at it as a scientific level, so that's why it made sense a little bit to me. And then being, you know, thrown into the lab, having to follow a lot different thought patterns than just like red, green, and blue. You start thinking like levels of intensity of light mixed in with certain things. Like, it's just a different thought pattern you have to rethink. So that's why I wanted to get involved, because it'd be really nice to be able to like look at some of the beginning students that are coming out who don't look at this in a data captured way and explain to them, no, this is a measured data set.
Right.
There's reasons they're the values that they are. I mean, please don't, you know, this isn't something you're just taking a photograph of, reprojecting it.
Please don't multiply it by 1.4.
Yes. Please don't multiply it.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Don't put a curve on it. No.
No.
Or pinch the levels.
Yeah.
Or
I want it to be rougher. No. It's acquired data. So what I want to do is a big thing in terms of, I mean, obviously we're looking at a lot of things in WikiHumans, all the way down to, Uncanny Valley and psychological and animation and all kinds of stuff we want to get to. But more specifically, because we're very involved with you guys right now, is literally what is objective and what is subjective in terms of that exact analysis. Like what you guys are giving is an objective thing. It's measured data, and the level of which, when you'd want to, if you want it to look realistic or as realistic as it's supposed to, use that data as objectively as possible and save your subjective decisions the same way that you would do in photography, like your lighting and your cameras and your things like that.
I think it's also a little bit like the transition towards physically based rendering, where it used to be rendering wasn't physically based, so you do your artistic decisions while you're setting things up in the first place, but now the rendering is physically based.
Right. That's so actually way simpler to
It's
do
simpler.
Things.
When you set things up, you don't have to make these kind of judgments about shadows or whatever.
Right.
You can do that when you're doing your artistic choices.
Right.
You're not like, and when you're writing a shader, you're not necessarily making artistic choices at that time.
Yep.
It's when you've written it and it works, and then you do your art with it.
Right.
So maybe, so now we've got this sort of physically based maps.
Right.
And the question
is, how do they fit correctly? And that's what I'm trying to understand.
We're still working out some of the details, because there's a few things going on there.
Right.
I mean, I'm coming in all hoity-toity and
go ahead
saying everybody's doing it wrong, but obviously, you know, some people
do it
right.
No, I don't think you're doing it wrong, but the thing is,
it's not an easy thing.
No, what you're doing, I'll tell you one of the issues, right, if it's okay. One of the issues is that you're doing it, and everyone has a different way of interpreting how, let's say, skin is supposed to be done. Even if they're using the same renderer that just gives them a standard shader, they're going to make some other weird map mix thing of whatever they believe skin needs to be done. And that's based on whatever color they happen to be painting when they've done character work, right? They'll make some monster and they paint some weird color mixture, and this is how they do it, and that's how they do it. And everyone has a different way of doing it. So when they get scanned accurate data from you guys, they want to try to shove this into their methodology of doing skin, even though it's different. So there is no standard way of doing skin. And it's what we're starting to understand when we're starting to talk to you, is like, okay, like your single scatter map, how does that fit in as a shader?
Right. Well, hopefully it goes in the single scatter node. But,
but there is no – not everyone has a single scatter node, right? So you have to understand how that fits. So it's up to us to define it. However, as far as a shader is concerned, all the math, the root level math is kind of similar. Single subsurface scattering follows the same laws that most
– Yeah, it's more like, how does that particular – shader interpret the maps when it goes and puts all the math together.
Because everyone who has a skin shader, like a skin shader, is like, for example, in V-Ray, it's just a series of blend shaders with different subsurfaces, right? And so we could actually break it apart into multiple shaders and then people could understand it. It'd be a really complicated thing, but it would break it apart. What I want to do is understand what is it that you guys are getting and how do we use this and can it give us back to the skin what we want? And so make a new broken out map. And then actually, if you do it fundamentally correct, you could technically do it in whatever rendering engine you want. And that's also
a goal. That's something that we're trying to map out with the WikiHuman, right?
Yeah.
So I started seriously learning about this stuff probably 2009.
Yeah.
And it's taken quite a while just to figure things out and learn what people were already doing. And
yeah, and you're not a dumb guy either.
Papers and so on.
Yeah.
But even now, there's some things that are a little bit fuzzy. But that's mostly
because of peach fuzz?
Well, we don't talk about peach fuzz, at least not yet. You see what you did?
You threw him off his groove.
Threw him off your groove, sorry. Things are a little bit fuzzy.
Come on, Graham.
Right, so
come
on. It has a lot to do with photographing an actual object. And in real life, we've got like one of the best global illumination algorithms is the real universe, right?
Right.
Maybe the best.
The one in the real world?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's pretty good.
It's good, right?
Yeah, it's really good. I use it every day. No artifacts. Yeah. None.
Well, there's a few artifacts late at night.
Late at night? How's that?
You know, you can start to see the noise a bit.
Yeah. Well,
if the lights are real low, it's kind of.
Depends on your camera. Well, would your eyeballs? Not really.
Yeah, you can. You totally can.
You think you see noise with your eyes?
Yeah, in a dark room when your eyes adjust, you see that.
Little spots.
The snow.
Those are floaters. You're supposed to have those.
No, not the floaters. I mean the fuzz, the noise. You can see the noise. You should try it sometime. It's awesome.
Okay.
Real dark. Get your eyes adjusted. Look around, and you see the dots dancing.
Should we just turn off the lights right now?
No. You have to have your eyes completely dilated, which takes about 20 minutes.
After you adjust and you look at your hand or whatever.
Okay.
Oh, there's a couple of fun things. That's total sidetrack, but it's worth it.
Okay.
One thing is your shutter speed gets longer.
In your eyeballs.
In your eye, yeah.
So you think you see motion blur.
When you move your hand back and forth real fast, it looks blurrier than in the day. That's pretty cool.
Okay.
And the noise that you see, that's the same kind of noise that you see on a camera.
So you think you're basically your eyeballs have an ISO.
Yeah, the eyes have an ISO. What was it?
I don't know. I'm
you measured it out one time. You can kind of get an idea of it just by comparing.
Really?
Get a rough idea.
You know what I'm doing tonight, right?
Yeah, probably. And of course, you can see your aperture, right? It's just how big your eye is.
Yeah, how big your eye is.
Your eye. You can measure the thing.
You can measure the iris, yeah.
That's your aperture. Yeah. So it's kind of a camera, right? So it's not it's not magic.
It's kind of why I've always wanted to be a giant squid, so I have really big eyeballs.
So anyway, you can see the Monte Carlo noise of the universe.
Really?
The Monte Carlo noise of the universe. I like that.
Late at night. See those dots? Those are photons.
Really?
It's great. Holy mind blow, right?
Total mind blow.
Can we put that on a t-shirt? Monte Carlo?
If you want.
That is a great... Okay, well, first of all, you see? This is why we don't edit the podcast.
If you rendered that night scene with Fix 100, it would be wrong.
You're saying that basically there is a threshold that we have to maximize no matter what.
You got to get Vlado to figure
Vlado,
out.
Vlado.
How many photons are there? Is it too many? It's too many, man.
Vlado, there's too many photons in your render. Really?
It's not realistic, man.
There's actually a fixed number of photons in an image. That is crazy crap.
Yeah, that's probably much better than whatever else I was talking about.
No.
Okay. And now we're off topic again.
I mean, we're a little bit off topic, but it's a good one. I like it.
Oh, okay. Well, there was something I was trying to say.
Fuzzy.
Yeah. Because we're
back to fuzzy.
Taking photographs that are rendered by the real world, right? There's a lot of stuff going on there that we might not be thinking about. So it's got, you know, all your inner reflections and all the GI stuff. It's got everything you could possibly
possibly
have. And when we when we get maps out of this data, we're not really undoing all of that. Mm. So ideally, you kind of reverse the entire rendering process to get back to the maps.
Okay.
But we can only do some of that practically. So there's still, you know, I think going forward, we'll improve things, make it more friendly. But it'll take a little while to really reverse all those processes.
Okay.
But anyway, we do get some pretty good maps to go into the diffuse layer, which has some subsurface in there. And you get your single scattering, which doesn't have subsurface.
You guys get some very, very, the stuff that takes a long time to for an artist to figure out and to interpolate, right? The fine stuff of the skin and the face, right? And for example, you know, I hate to say it, but the eyeballs are easier for an artist to deal with, but you guys obviously can't scan the eyeballs with your current way of working.
Well, scanning a specular object in that type of stage isn't going to work.
Right. And the same with teeth, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I think that you can, you know what I interpret it as?
Teeth kind of work, actually. Teeth,
well, yeah.
You don't get a very good specular map on it, but they...
You can get the geometry from the diffuse.
Mm.
Another problem that confounds the eyes is the eyelashes getting in the way all the time.
Yes.
If you just, you know, if you could wax your eyelashes before you...
It's actually bad for you, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think we've ever requested anybody actually wax their eyelashes.
No, but let's talk about the eyes a little bit because you and I have gone through this with Daniel Buck. We've discussed this in terms of cost.
Where is Daniel? Why isn't he here?
He went home early, I guess. Right. But anyway, listen, he will be on podcast again. But I always equate it to scanned heads are like the scanned car from when we were at Sway. We used to do a lot of commercials.
Yeah.
And then the eyeballs are like the CAD data that we always requested.
And the eyeballs are an image map that somebody pasted on the...
Right. So,
like the headlights.
Right.
The headlights were a photo of the headlights.
So I always think, like, if you do an accurate, anatomically correct eye that someone modeled, anatomically correct, it actually works really well, but you use the scanned face. So you sort of fit the eyeball into the... I don't think people's eyeballs shapes, color, yes, but I don't think their eyeball shapes are massively different from each other.
Massively, no. Maybe but I have heard they are slightly different.
Yeah, they wouldn't be as different as different faces, but there'd be some variation.
But if I took someone else's eyeballs and put them into your eye with the same color, it would be...
You may get away with it.
I may get away with it. Yeah.
I don't want to be there for that.
If you swapped the rest of the face and kept the eyes, probably wouldn't get away with that.
Well, that's cool. So what is your goal for what do you guys think about being part of the WikiHuman project? Do you think it's gonna be cool?
I think there's gonna be a lot of useful like information in it for artists in particular.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only side I can talk about from.
Yeah, I feel like it took such a long time to even figure out what we figured out so far.
Yep.
So we should help other people with that information instead of asking everybody to go figure it out for themselves.
Right. It's a good kind of repository for this information. That's what I'm seeing it as.
And explaining the logic behind it helps people understand why.
And there's so many different things. Obviously, to be honest, right now we're focusing on this because you guys are really awesome with your time and your data that you're giving us to experiment with and to find out and to have a communication about. But there is a lot more that we want to do. Once we have this data, it sort of starts the foundation for a lot of the other things we want to do. It starts the foundation towards understanding how this gets used for animation and how far animation needs to be and how accurate animation needs to be and how far, you know, I want to keep going into all kinds of ideas of animation. And then also, once we've got that, then I feel we have a good foundation to using this data towards understanding the Uncanny Valley and going into that aspect of it. And just keep going and going. So far, that's all I've gotten. But every time I turn the corner and we start discussing this, we start to see other things that are possible, other ideas we can do. And I really, you know, appreciate the fact that you guys have been so cool about making this happen and allowing that. And Paul's been really great. I'd love to get Paul on this. I know he's super busy, but it'd be cool to get Paul on here and have him do a little podcast.
I don't think he'd mind.
Yeah. I don't think he'd mind. Yeah. Well, that's cool. Yeah. I like Paul. I think he's fun. He's a lot of fun. I made it in one of the podcasts, we had described the fact that, and it was You and I were at that because we've discussed it on this podcast several times. SIGGRAPH 2007 in San Diego. I was
right.
You, your wife, and I were all hanging out together going to SIGGRAPH, and that's when I was. Paul was introducing me to the double secret probation parties that I didn't even know existed. he was just going kind of crazy back then. It was pretty funny. Yeah,
I think if you wanted anything explained very clearly, you should probably get Paul on here.
All right, let's talk about that real briefly because I think this is something that I think is really interesting about Paul. To be honest, Paul is an amazing researcher. There's a lot of amazing researchers out there, but I think what stands out to me in terms of Paul, specifically from an artist point of view, right? This is back when I saw Fiat Lux and even before that when he did the Campanile project when he was still in school. What he does better than anyone, in my mind, is explain what he does.
He's an excellent public speaker and explain the concepts of everything behind it.
Yeah, but he does it in a way that he explains things, certainly not dismissing them as being simple, but explains them simple enough that almost everyone can understand what he's talking about. And that's, I think a lot of people, especially when they go to SIGGRAPH, they want to put these gigantic titles into their presentations that no one understands and are abstract, is just trying to show off how smart they are, as opposed to actually explaining what they're actually doing. And I think that Paul managed to do that. And that's
guilty as charged.
What's that?
Guilty as charged.
Yes. But the thing I think is what's interesting is that Paul goes out there and he explains it so everyone understands it. And that's why everyone goes, wow, did you see what this guy did? And they look at it and they understand it and it appeals to a wider audience. And I think that's an important part of that understanding. And I'd like to do that with The Uncanny Valley or any of this stuff with WikiHumans. I want to make it understandable so that if someone wants to look up digital humans, they don't have to be a CG background. They can read the blog and it's very much understandable as to what we're actually doing. And there's a place for – obviously there are certain things you can't do without explaining it scientifically or doing whatever you guys are doing because there's too much foundation based in there for you to do that. But I still think that there's something very special about explaining things in regular language. And you do that pretty well, Graham. I wouldn't dismiss that. It's conversationally speaking, you do that really well. I haven't read any of your papers, unfortunately. So,
yeah, maybe that's why you haven't read any. Well, it's a skill, right? And it's not always easy.
No, but you always have these ideas. Whenever you say, okay, I got this idea. I'm going to do flashlight and this and that, and I'm going to get that. And you explained how you scanned that coin to me, and I got it. I understood what you were saying. When he did that, it was a pretty cool technique.
And then he looks at me and goes, it's going to work great.
That's exactly what he said. He says, don't worry. It's going to be great. There was always that pause before great.
Yep. Yeah. Every time. Still does.
Yep. I still love – there was one piece of software that you made. I forgot. Crinkletron, I think it was.
Yes.
Crinkletron.
That was the thing to add – little wrinkles and prinkles to a cloth simulation.
Right, to make it more realistic.
Is this a plugin?
Yeah. It's a piece of standalone software.
And it had the worst interface ever.
Yeah.
That was a button. Just, it said worst interface ever.
It's just like a quick slap together GUI so people could use it in production.
Right.
It was the most horrible GUI. So it literally said that on it.
Yeah, you basically just put the map in there or the data you needed, and then you hit this button that said worst interface ever, and that's all you did, and something came out the other end. I don't know why you bothered with a GUI. You could have just made it command line.
I was going to ask something similar, but okay.
There's a reason for it.
Yeah. But it was really funny. All right.
What is that other thing you always say? What is it? You always say... it's going to be great. And then there's another thing you say. It's like, damn it, what is it?
I often say that something is going to be fine.
Yeah, it's going to be fine.
I say, it's fine.
It's fine. Yeah, Daniel says that all the time. Like major disasters happen. Like, you know, you get into a car wreck. Probably fine. Yeah. Someone tried to hack into something. It's like all your data is, you know, like when all of my data gets stolen by Sony, thank you very much.
Whoever
the Sony hacker was. And I'm pretty sure it was in North Korea, but anyway, we'll not get into that. Anyways, Elma and Daniel look at me and goes, probably fine. So yeah, it was pretty funny. All right. Do you guys know how we end the podcast?
Uh-uh.
You haven't listened to a whole one?
I kept getting interrupted.
Oh.
I don't get to sit down
much these days.
Ohms?
We should do ohms.
What are ohms?
You know, ohm.
Oh, you mean like yoga ohms?
No. We do actually. You know what? Actually, I'm going to do something different. Is there anything that you want to hear on a podcast?
Oh.
Who would you like to have on a podcast?
We've already had Vlado.
Vlado,
that's,
yes.
That's just a.
Yep.
That's a good one right there.
Yep. Anything else? Well, we talked about Paul being on the podcast.
Yeah, that would be good.
That'd be good. I think Mike Seymour might be in town, and I did a podcast for him on FX Guide. I want to turn the tables on him and see if I can get him.
I'd be interested in that, actually.
Yeah. It'd be cool because he's doing some really interesting stuff as well, and I think he's a really interesting guy.
I think maybe get into some case studies once you have some cases to study.
Okay.
Of like what? Virtual characters?
People who have done the virtual characters in productions recently.
Well, we talked to Steve Prieg.
Yeah, I mean, like more people.
Yeah, okay.
That's almost
so
like,
more people. Well, I've done Steve Prieg. I've done a couple of people from Blur. I've done that.
I mean, yeah, but especially people who are currently trying to use
digital
humans.
Okay.
So. I'd like to hear a couple of render artists in general, honestly, just to understand their peel downs and thought processes and why they
Oh, you want to understand technically why they're doing what they're doing, not just how they started their career or whatever.
I like learning things.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. So this seems like to be a thing. And a reminder to the audience that if you guys have any ideas, you can email us at labs@chaosgroup.com or you can tweet at us. We do have a Twitter. It's CG_labs. So go ahead and do that. And that's it. Any other parting comments before we go? Graham? Jake?
I was going to see if there's any more donuts left.
Yeah, there are donuts left.
Okay.
Probably. Jay, is there anything you would like?
Just hoping I didn't sound too ridiculous on
this. No. You see, you will soon see.
That's what I'm afraid of.
You don't sound ridiculous. It's going to be a great podcast. I already know it's a great podcast. So anyway.
Oh, so. I should say something like digital humans are awesome or something
like
that.
Oh, yeah, we should totally do that.
Why is that?
Because they are.
Well, and everybody should use digital humans and scan people, and it's really great.
Okay.
Subtle.
Seriously.
Real
guys.
Subtle.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
Well, we got to get someone. We got to get. Oh, wait. Because I've always been mentioning Gina in every podcast, and she hates the fact. It's just like I was talking about how we're going to get Gina scanned, and she says, there's no effing way that you're going to scan me.
You probably should then.
We probably should, right?
I'll scan it. Yeah. I'll run the scan.
But she just has one of herself. You guys did scan Daniel Buck, though, right?
Yeah.
When was that?
That was a while back for a little experiment on facial hair.
Oh, this was your private scanning session during the weekend or something, right?
Well, it was for research.
Well, I know, but I'm saying you were by yourself, a little secret.
Hey, baby, can I scan you?
it was
I don't know.
Related.
I wasn't there.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. That's cool.
He's been scanned once.
Yeah, I've had this inkling. I want to scan Vlado next time.
That'd be great, yeah.
Because he's got a pretty good facial structure, too. He would be really interesting to get scanned.
Who's the fuzzy chin on our website?
Hmm?
Your paper is represented by a rainbow fuzzy chin
on
our website.
Well, there is Daniel and Andrew and myself in the facial hair.
Yep.
So I think it's Daniel, actually, on our front page. I think he's on our front page.
There you go. Daniel Buck. The heavy and V-Ray IRL. That's right. Everyone knows last, like, I can't believe that's Daniel. He's such a nice, calm, sweet guy, and he's there with a shotgun blowing people away. So, yeah, it's pretty funny. All right. We should wrap it up because it's right about an hour. And our sign-off is, and that's the last bucket because of the rendering. You wait for that last bucket?
Right.
You've done enough car renders that's where you know that last bucket is hanging on that headlight. Forever.
Yeah, especially if it's like.
I thought you said those are pictures posted on the front.
What?
The headlights. He just said they're an image you placed on.
You get the real headlights.
Yeah,
when you get that last little bucket. That's
yeah.
You don't when know
we
how
do
long
the way we
take.
Yeah we do the real headlight. The way you do it properly is you do CAD specific headlights where you have the entire internals correctly modeled, including the filament, and you light the filament, and you see the light bouncing around correctly.
Yeah.
A lot of ray tracing and very complicated, and the last bucket always just ends up hanging on that headlight. Yeah. it's pretty hardcore.
Or on the horizon line, if you've got a really complicated environment.
Yeah. I'll tell you one specifically. Just a little sidetrack. Was working on Oblivion, and we're going into the Tet, right? And a ship's going in, and there's the door's opening, and you see the little ship going in there. And I had the Tet modeled correctly, which is 13 miles long, right?
Dang.
And it was all this massive texture and everything else. And I've got Vlad, and I was like, why is it taking forever? And he goes, well, the last bucket is like 3 miles long. So there's a lot of texture filtering to be done. It's really complicated. It's like, oh. It was just so, it's like, of course it is. That's like the longest pixel ever, you know?
Three-mile pixel.
It was like ridiculous because I'm looking down the barrel of this thing that says like, oh. Because so he's like, that's actually a pretty good render time considering what you were trying to do. It's like, yeah, I didn't realize it was that. So.
What was the bottom line render time?
Oh, it depends. It actually was not necessarily that. It was how much I had to, how many samples I had to throw at it to get the noise to go away, which was insane. It was pretty much like, instead of 1/100 wasn't enough, I had to do 1/1000 or something silly like that. Right. And the shader was very simple because it's just a flat surface with some breakup on it. But it was, they still couldn't get the noise to go away because it was just so, you can't throw 200 samples on something that's 2 miles wide. You know, it's like you have to throw it higher than that. Oops. Sorry, I got, that is my alarm because I have to actually do something. So I am going to go ahead and sign off the podcast. And thank you guys so much for coming. And we will put this podcast up actually pretty soon because I want it to be up for the announcements of WikiHuman page, which is up and running. And a lot of people have gone to see it. And it's gotten great. a lot of good press. So
I've been sending a lot of people there, actually.
Cool. Thank you, Jay. Thank you. All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's
the last bucket.
The last bucket. All right.